Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 1st, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Karen Bloomquist. Today's session number is BIK98-5, and it is titled Be, Discern, Act, the Church's Public Witness. Let's listen in.
I'm Karen Bloomquist, and I've been doing a series all week on Be, Discern, Act. What I'd like to do today is present some ideas that could probably be put under the theme, when our society is becoming so privatized and so focused on private concerns, the church must go public. And I want to begin by saying some things and including some theological undergirdings for why I would make that kind of assertion. It's my increasing conviction that the church's retreat from engagement with the public realm, in other words, from the social, the economic, the political issues of our day, is a central theological issue of faith. Fancy way of talking about that is, and what I would want to assert is that it basically becomes a status confessionis. You know, a few years ago, the churches were very involved in saying, you know, apartheid is a status confessionis. I think in the face of how some of these wider structural realities are shaping our world today, especially the global economy, and next week's session we'll be talking a bit more about that, not only in my sessions, but I sense also in some of the other sessions. In the face of that, and at the same time, when so much of us, for many Americans especially, there's much more of a retreat from the private and a focusing on private concerns, kind of me, myself, my family, maybe my immediate neighborhood, and probably the normal way of saying it is, well, take hell with the rest of it. You know, I really don't want to be bothered by all of that. I think it's reflected in, you know, the low voter turnout, the fact that some of the voluntary associations that used to be a part of people's life are less so. And then there's others who say, well, that may not be the case. It may be a mixed kind of picture there. But I think what has often happened for us in the church, and why I think this is such a critical matter, is that we end up reducing our understanding of the faith to mostly a focus on just the second article. You know, I believe in Jesus Christ, and then we end up interpreting that in a very privatized kind of way. The main thing we think about when we think of Jesus Christ is the meaning of Jesus Christ for our personal salvation. Now, I don't want to be mistaken. I don't want to deny how pivotally important that is. But what I want to suggest is that focus, lodged as it is within this kind of privatizing tendency in our society, tends to function in a way that cuts us off from being challenged by the public implications of what we confess in, for example, the first and the third articles of the Creed. You know, that God has created all that is, and not just created what is of nature, but also what is of history and the kind of social and political and economic institutions, that too is a part of what God's creation is all about. And so when we end up focusing things so narrowly, it's no wonder that emphases in the church like social ministry or public policy advocacy tend to be seen as pretty peripheral in many of our congregations. Obviously, there's some exceptions, but I think for many of us, it's like, well, evangelism in a narrow sense of that word, or you know, individual salvation becomes kind of the sum total of what we see the church, or the heart of what the church is to be about. I think that becomes a real problem, because part of what we as Christians proclaim is that God is active in the whole of life, including in all those public arenas of life. And when we write those off as if, well, that's all that secular stuff off there, I think there's a really critical faith issue that's at stake. That we really collapse the meaning of the faith that we confess. And so I would say it's not so much a matter of the church trying to become socially relevant or politically active, but although certainly one could look at it in those terms, but it is a matter of the church being called to bear witness to the fullness of what God is about, to all the ways that God is active, and through all of the relationships and the institutional realities in which our lives are embedded. And that call to see that out there, policies and practices occur that might be more just and sustainable for all creation. And I think when we narrow things in, we miss that broad scope of what it is that we as the church, and I mean the church ecumenical, have been confessing for two millennia, and certainly going further back in terms of our Jewish roots and the way in which that comes alive in some powerful ways there. I think what we need to do, therefore, and the real challenge in this kind of theme of when society goes private, the church must go public, is to realize and give more attention to how God is continually pulling us out of our private cocoons, including our privatizing churches, and into the public, where we are enmeshed in the world of others, where we encounter those who are different from us, who are different from us economically, racially, who differ from us in their worldviews, in their ideologies, in their interests, in their preferences. And so I really think this is more and more an issue of faith in churches in the United States, and in the face of how much these wider forces are impacting our lives and distorting and dehumanizing our lives in so many ways, I think it becomes a real urgent kind of thing for us to give attention to that. Just let me just pause if there's a question. I'm going to go on, but I just want to give a little space in case somebody has a question or comment at this point. Just a historical word about this whole separation of private and public life, which I think is especially present in our society today. There's been lots and lots of analyses of those, and I'm not going to spend the time to get into them now, other than to point out that, for example, for the ancient Greeks, the polis, the public arena, was seen as the space of meaning and value. And for us, at the end of the 20th century, it's almost exactly the opposite. The private arena of home and family and personal intimacy is usually considered the place of real meaning and real value. And that, of course, is where our typical congregations have most readily connected with people's lives, and sometimes totally connected there, so that address of the wider public realities doesn't happen. And that private realm is where outsiders tend to be excluded or feel out of place. In the public arena, and probably what is the nature of the public, is that it is where different human beings with different interests and perspectives live together in the same space, and where we've got to find some way of getting along together, even with those people that we really don't feel we have much in common with, other than, you know, we somehow live in the same community and we somehow live in the same world, and therefore we are somehow part of the same thing, but we don't, in a lot of other ways, we don't feel we have a lot in common. The public, as Aristotle pointed out, is where justice is required to transform private interests into common interests through public conversation. And as many have pointed out, the crisis of democracy today is that political apathy has grown as more public things are moving toward the private arena. I think, as examples here in this country, we could think of all the discussions going on of, well, let's privatize the Social Security system so everyone would have their own kind of accounts and, you know, and you do your own investments. All the ways in which hospital, you know, a lot of previous public services are being privatized, usually in the name of efficiency and, you know, doing it according to business principles is more efficient. But I think continually we need to raise questions about what about the common good, what gets lost in the process, what about those who are the most vulnerable, who are often the most negatively affected when that privatizing goes on. And even in the realm of politics or electoral politics, more and more of the discussion going there is primarily focused on private concerns. I think a lot of that came up in some of the debates over campaign reform and lots of other debates in Washington where the passion that's connected with certain private concerns far exceeds the passion or motivation to address some of the wider public realities of what's going on in our society and in our world today. Whereas in medieval Europe, the care of souls was, in a sense, public, in modern society, religion has become an intensely private matter. And thus the church ends up shaping its pitch, its evangelism, its outreach in terms of what individuals and their consumer tastes want. In other words, what will play to the market. This picks up on a theme I was dealing with on Monday when we were talking about the growth of incivility and the predominance of market values as determining everything in our society. And therefore, the church gets caught up in that too, in terms of how we fight some of our battles, not in a very civil way at times, and in terms of when we decide what, you know, what's worth doing? Well, what's the bottom line? Richard Sennett, in his book, The Fall of Public Man, pointed out some time ago that we have become captive to an ideology of intimacy with warmth as our God. And in light of all that, it's no coincidence that a survey that was done in the ELCA within the last couple of years, people were asked to ask, what image do you associate with your local congregation? What do you think of your congregation as being? Anybody want to guess what got the highest percentage of responses?
Family,
yeah. The vast majority, I don't have the specific, is, you know, 70-80% probably, at least aspire to see their local congregation as family. The bottom of the scale got something like, I don't know, 1-3% of responses was something of seeing our church as a beacon for justice and peace in the world. That was the very bottom of, I mean, there were about 10 different responses that people could choose. And so I think for a church to remain private in an increasingly privatized society is for the church to become a chaplain of the status quo. blessing what's going on, and therefore it becomes a reflective of the society's values rather than a place to challenge that from out of some faith understandings. Those of us who are Lutheran, I think, need to be reminded, and I'll mention Luther here, but I think in most of our traditions, one could think of lots of examples similar to this. What I'm struck with is how Luther was continually engaging social issues in what we today might refer to as the public arena. You know, if one looks at some of the things he wrote, you know, he was addressing issues of schools, of soldiers, of trade. Had some very, very strong words to say about some of the early monopolistic trade practices. And at one point even makes, you know, if you engage with that, you know, you're deserting the faith. I mean, he even made it a very basic faith issue in his essay, his treatise on trade and usury. He didn't wait, in other words, for the church's theological reforms to get settled, but he was continually addressing the public issues of his day in the midst of all this ongoing theological ferment. And so I think we can claim that in a sense, Luther was very much a public theologian. Certainly there have been some other things in our tradition, including certain distorted understandings of two kingdoms that have sometimes worked against that, even though I think even the two kingdoms understanding was an attempt to say, yeah, God is active throughout life. God is active through salvation, but God is also active, you know, through the whole created order. And I think one of the difficulties is we've lost a sense of how deeply our lives as individuals are embedded in all kinds of institutions. I've made mention before of the fact that in working on the Economic Life Social Statement, which we'll be looking at next week, one of the members of our task force, who very much is shaped by free market thinking, was just totally blown away by how Luther talked about the role of all these different institutions and seeing that people had the food they needed to live, including the role of government. You know, and there's, you know, when we pray, give us this day our daily bread, you know, we are really praying, yeah, God, help things to be arranged in society and policies to be in place so that it is possible for people to have their daily bread. Not just a matter of so individuals can on their own do it, but he counted on that, you know, maybe a different understanding of institutions than we might have today, but there was much more of a sense of how all these realities that are apart from just the private are a part of how God operates. And in that sense, it becomes an issue of faith. One popular Holden teacher and two who've taught here at Holden, Larry Rasmussen and Cynthia Molabita, have in their essay for the book The Promise of Lutheran Ethics that is just being published right now and will be out very soon, they point out in some very eloquent ways how for Luther all of creation is the very abode of God. God is truly and powerfully in, with, and under all that is creaturely. In other words, all those realms of life that we often don't associate with God. So I want to go on today and point to a passage in Scripture, and I've put a few Bibles around. We're not going to do a detailed text study, but those of you who have one near you might want to look up Isaiah 58. I think it's just one of many passages that we could look at where the church's public calling is I think dramatically emphasized. Isaiah 58 begins with the refrain, shout, shout out, do not hold back. In other words, go public, not a privatized faith, but a shouting, kind of the drums out in the street like we just heard then. Don't keep it to yourself. And throughout the biblical witness, but here especially in the prophetic writings, a faith focused on private acts of religiosity that primarily serve the self-interest of its followers is strongly critiqued. We're not going to read through this, but as I'm talking, you may just want to scan that particular passage. And especially what's critiqued is forsaking the ordinances of God, especially those having to do with the poor. Why do you fast? Why do you humble yourself? The prophet asks rhetorically and goes on to charge, you serve your own interests and you oppress all your workers. In contrast to a focus on what's in it for me, the kind of privatized focus, the fast to which God calls us is boldly set forth, as you move on in that chapter, to loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, to break every yoke. In other words, it's not just a shouting out, but it's also acting to change policies and practices that enslave others in our communities, in the wider society, in the world. And that clarion call to be about God's work in this way is seen as central to the calling of faith. A calling of faith that continues in verse 12 by talking about being called to be repairers of the breach, restorers of streets to live on, which to me is just a powerful call, particularly if you live as I do in the midst of cities that are falling apart and all the kind of the kind of loss of community, the breakdown of structures in so many parts of our society. I think that last verse in verse 12 is also a very powerful mandate for the church to be involved in things like community organizing. Taking seriously the social, the economic, political context where we find ourselves and the injustices that are there, and in acting to redress them. In the midst of that action, we experience in profoundly new ways God's gracious transforming activity. In other words, the heart of what God is about stirs us, opens us up in some new ways in the midst of that engagement. Public ministry affects how we view our private lives. I've been really impressed with how many pastors, including my husband when he was involved in church-based community organizing in Queens, New York, how it changed the way in which he preached and the way in which the people in that congregation understood their faith. It came alive for them in some new ways. We begin to discern some of the public factors underlying the private pains in people's lives, how injustices out there, whether it's in the workplace or in the political structure, generate dis-ease and wreak havoc in our personal and political lives. One of the books that I think sets us forth in a very compelling and very accessible way is a book by Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, who's also taught here at Holden, in his book, Families Valued. He takes that kind of rhetoric of family values, and he said, well, let's really talk about what it would mean to have families valued, namely, to look at how these wider forces are affecting family life. So part of what I'm wanting to make clear is that I don't want you to walk out of here saying I'm against the focus on families, but what I'm saying is or the personal and the intimate, but that we need to look at how these wider public policies and structures are wreaking havoc in lots of ways, with families, with personal, with the private arena of life. When we engage in public ministry and participate in community initiatives or organizations, one of the things that happens is we encounter those who are different from us, who may not share our presuppositions, who may not share our faith, and yet we roll up our sleeves and we work together because of some kind of common ground we share. I'm a firm believer that ecumenism and interfaith progress is made not so much whether we get all the right theological understandings together, but it occurs more often than not as we work together. The other night here, talking about or hearing from Ron Young about the Interfaith Committee for Peace in the Middle East and the way in which Muslims and Christians and Jews working together and finding some commonality in the midst of that. One of the other examples, just to give a more community-based example, in Chicago there's an interfaith initiative to address concerns of environmental and economic sustainability for the whole metropolitan area. I've been a kind of fringe member of the group that's working on it, and they've just come out with this whole study, One Creation, One People, One Place, with all kinds of studies they've done of, hey, this is what the future of the greater Chicago area is going to be like. And this is going to be kind of the platform for a lot of organizing in congregations, synagogues, mosques across both within the city and in the surrounding suburban areas to say, what would it mean for us really to pull together and address some of these matters? Now, I'm not saying that's the only example. I think in a lot of metropolitan and also smaller town areas, there's a lot of those kinds of initiatives going on. But I think it's so important in our churches for us to be clear about how that is how the work of God is getting done. That is part of the public witness of the people of God, those who share our faith and those who don't. And I think that's some of the exciting kinds of stuff that we as the people of God are called to be about. Maybe just one or two more things, and then we can open this up for discussion and hear some of your thoughts, some of your examples of how you see this happening. One of the other themes theologically that emerges when we begin to do this is we encounter those who are different from us. And another passage that I find very helpful for thinking about this is from Ephesians 2. You know, it's that, Pat, you may want to look it up, Ephesians 2, 13 to 18. It's that whole passage of at the heart of the gospel is Christ's action of making separated, even oppositional groups into one, which I think is another way of talking about the public implications of the gospel. Historically, the church has all too often stirred up new hostilities rather than incarnating and living out the power of Christ to embrace and transform those very real differences. It is in society that we find the God we know in Christ to be active and alive, where people are connecting and finding some commonality despite their very real differences. And community begins to take shape across those boundaries that divide. In March, I was privileged to be in India for a week and a half as part of a Lutheran World Federation consultation. And there was a glimpse of how that occurs as we were visiting one of that city's, this was in Madras, India, one of that city's poorest slums. And it was a place where an ecumenical community organizing effort was underway. And what struck me most was the way in which, you know, the children, of course, kept trying to reach out to touch us. I mean, that's probably not an, I mean, that's kind of typical kind of, you know, who are these people with pale skins and all the rest. But I want, but I saw something more deeply in that. There was this profound human need to make connection with strangers, with those who were as different from them in every way imaginable. You know, they weren't asking for a handout. That was very clear. It was just, I want to touch. I want, you know, want to hold on to your hand. This one girl kept, you know, taking me all over the village. I tried to take her picture at the end, and of course all the boys tried to squeeze her out of the picture. They didn't want her to be in the picture, even though she was probably the most vibrant organizer of the 10-year-olds in that community. It was like patriarchy kind of rushed in when I tried to give attention to what she was about. And it was also interesting that it was especially a community organizing effort involving women without any formal education, who had, as they banded together, discovered a power to confront the political power of that community. These slums in the edge of, or they're sprinkled throughout Madras, actually, are basically not owned by anyone, and so they're basically squatter huts that go up there, and so continually the government is trying to clear them out and reclaim that land. And so this community was organizing and saying, we need and we deserve a place to live here. And it was incredible listening to the women talk, who basically said, oh, I couldn't even speak for myself, and I've never gone to school. But I went to, you know, the seat of government, and I protested, and, you know, and here was this community that was still hanging together and had a real vibrancy to it. Whenever in that or in any society distinctions of caste or political or economic level no longer get in the way of people working together for the sake of the well-being of communities, wherever people are working together for the sake of genuine justice, wherever that occurs, we as church can and must proclaim God to be active. It's not that we necessarily bring God to the people, but God, who is justice, is there already. If only we can listen, see, feel, and thus bear public testimony to God's presence among the least of our sisters and brothers. So I think that, in conclusion, I think what that part of what that implies is that our faith communities need to truly bear witness to the gospel's power to break down all kinds of dividing walls in our society, to send us forth and where we encounter the stranger. And it's not that the church somehow gets its own act together and then goes out into the world, which usually means we never get around to that. But that the heart of what we as church proclaim becomes real in the crucible of the world, at those points where hostilities are sometimes the sharpest. And I think as church folk, we have to ask hard questions about what it means to experience that kind of transformation that is ours through the gospel, not only in the private arenas of life, but in the public arenas. So that's kind of my basis for saying why I think we need to take much more seriously than we have the church's public calling in an increasingly privatized society. Responses, examples, comments. What does this raise for you?
Yeah, one comment. Sometime in the last year or so, I was reading something about the nonprofit status of churches. And a comment in there stated that a lot of churches actually function with a private chaplain, meaning they're so in focused But what we do is we keep our building open, and we have our pastor who is a chaplain to us, which is fine. But then I thought that's a question we need to keep raising. What are we doing to benefit society? And if we're not, then maybe we are just hiring a private chaplain.
Yeah, because that nonprofit status, clearly the premise for it is this is a good in society to have these churches here. And are we, in fact, any good to society?
I think we have to ask that continually, and then we have to evaluate where we're at. Even if we think we're doing it, are we doing it effectively, and how can we do more?
Did I understand your initial premise in terms of describing churches as withdrawing from the public arena? You feel? Then
I'm welcoming counter evidence to
right,
that.
No. But I'm just intrigued. Then that suggests that they're withdrawing from some sort of optimum level. Do you look back at a point that you feel was a better balance, or are we pursuing something different here? Could be both, but do you look back in an optimum?
I don't necessarily want to say there was some kind of golden age. I mean, some would say, well, maybe in the 60s and early 70s, maybe there was more address of, you know, for example, during the 60s, the time of the Civil Rights Movement. Now, again, that didn't necessarily include all churches, but I think there was a more focused activism to some degree. And I think particularly now, when things are, you know, supposedly going great economically, you know, for those of us who are middle class, it is all too easy for us to say, oh well, you know, let's just kind of keep things going, and you know, we don't have to worry about these wider social issues because, gee, things are going okay. In other words, our vision can become very narrow, I think, in times. I think there is, you know, I don't have lots of studies or statistics that say, oh yeah, there was all this, you know, that can quantify what the situation was, say, some years ago and what it is today. But I think there have been plenty of studies that have pointed to how we are much more privatized in our focus as a people than might have been the case in some earlier eras. Fulbert.
I would like to see something in favor of the church. Maybe it's a German example. In the 60s, in the late 60s, we had many groups in the church with us. We had peace groups or I don't know what, very political groups. But the church itself in its structures, it was not political. For example, in the synods and so on, political themes were not treated. But now, I think the church is like a tank, starting very slowly, but when she is started, when it started, you can't stop her. And that feeling I have, we have now, in the synods, in the structures of the church, a real political awareness. For example, when you ask in Germany somebody, where is the nest for asylum programs? Of course, church. Or another example...
For asylum?
Asylum programs. Another example in 80, 82, 83, we had in all schools, in the unions and so on, we had the decades, the peace decades. 1 week only speaking about the peace, or the peace and justice and so on. It's gone totally. But the old tank does it. The old church has this decades. And I think this kind of conservatism may be sometimes very good, as this kind of remembrance is.
The church is in there for the long haul.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Not just,
so pessimistic, I would say. I think when I, in our country, seek a place for asylum or peace or justice, or first year as seen in the churches. Not enough it may be, of course.
Yeah, and I would not want to say that, I don't want this to be totally dismal. I mean, I think there are some signs of it too. But at least my sense of the German church and the church in a lot of other parts of the world too is that it's much more engaged with some of these public realities than I think tends to be the case with the majority of our congregations in this country.
Well, what about if people in the same congregation vote differently on the social issues, then what do you do?
Well, and that's why I didn't really deal with it that much, but that's why I made reference to the Ephesians 2 passage. Because it seems as though if there's one arena in society, well, hopefully there's other arenas too, where we really can disagree and disagree yes. passionately, and in the midst of that say, now what is it that still unites us? What is it that enables us to still sit in there? Now I recognize there's a lot of forces, and I'd say they're the forces in society that mean, well, if this church talks about this issue or that issue, I'm leaving. You know, and this is where I think we have a real dilemma in terms of the church and the society, seeing, you know, you go to whatever church you want to go to, and if you don't like it there, you shop around. You know, we're talking about church shopping.
You do not even have the dilemma.
Yeah. And so I would say even around those difficult issues, you know, and that's where I think and I probably am indicting those of us who are preachers as much as anything, you know, have we spoken clearly enough to how the gospel does have that power to bridge those very real differences. I mean, I experienced this powerfully in India. It was a consultation mostly with Indian Lutherans there, and the Indian Lutheran Church, or there's nine different Lutheran church bodies in India, because they're different tribal caste groups. And Lutheran Church in India is especially the church of those who have been the outcasts. Not necessarily the church leaders, but it's mostly a rural church, and so that whole reality of what it means to be a church of the poor, and there is a whole Dalit liberation theology that's emerging there at the seminary. I was speaking at commencement at that seminary, and it was exciting to see all that they're doing around an indigenous liberation theology in there. But and actually, I used the Ephesians text, which was probably a little presumptuous for me. But I couldn't help but not use that text, because in Indian society, you just experience those differences. And we were there right after the election, and the huge hostility between Muslims and Hindus and Christians. The Christians being in some ways feeling really ostracized when those other two groups go at each other. That whole notion of, you know, what does it mean to live into, for us as Christians anyway, to live into the heart of an understanding of Christ who transforms those barriers. In other words, the differences there, if anything, are much more vicious than most of the differences we probably have in our congregation. And to say, yeah, there was that faith that somehow transformation of those differences can happen even when things are so vicious and so divided in a society. And I think that becomes a really important kind of witness to our faith. Now the question is, there's obviously a lot of practical considerations. Well, how to get people to hang around long enough to hear that before they walk away. So I don't want in any way to ignore the huge challenge of trying to proclaim that. But I think in a lot of places we've been far too, we meaning those of us that are church leaders, you know, local congregational leaders, be they pastors or lay leaders, saying, oh, we really don't want to touch that issue because that will make people nervous or not want to go. I think it's a matter of faith.
It's just that it seems that each person's understanding of what we proclaim is so different. I mean, what struck me in the verse in Ephesians is, ironically, it almost seems to me more and more in our day and age that our individual understandings and experiences of Christ seem to drive us farther apart.
Hmm.
And when I first, you know, read the title of your session, I wasn't sure whether you were asking, like, the church, meaning the United Methodist Church or the ELCA, to take some type of a social stand institutionally, or whether you're calling individuals within these churches to see their individual calling to act out their beliefs in acts of social justice.
I was focusing much more on the law. Unfortunately, Martin, when he added a little extra description, said, well, some about social statements. That it wasn't what I was planning on talking about this morning. I mean, I do that, and certainly part of, you know, the a national church body taking stances is part of that. But I'm much more persuaded that where that public action, that public witness of the church takes place, is in local communities.
By
and how we engage there,
as opposed to the institutions within that community.
Well, I'm pulling away from saying individuals, because I think it's individuals working together. So
right.
It is a corporate.
But you
there.
Wouldn't have to have an entire group of members of one organization,
right,
all doing the same thing. I guess when I look at the '60s and I look at now, I can't help but think that the retrenchment in terms of social justice action from the 60s to now was out of a sense of feeling burned, or it resulted in schisms within these institutions. I mean, I've read a lot of the history of that time, but I haven't really looked at it from the point of view of a church historian.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't know, you know. Someone the other day said they felt that one of the problems was that a lot of those social issue actions didn't really have faith base to them. So then when there was some criticism, there was nothing to fall back on. But I don't know if that's true or...
Yeah, I think there's a lot of factors involved in that.
It's pretty hard. I know if you got 10 Methodists together, they wouldn't agree on what social act, you know, what action to take based on their understanding of a verse in Isaiah.
I wanted to give an example of an individual from the church body that had a vision and how that blossomed and spread. I teach in Chicago, and I teach at a school that has a program called Life Directions. And Life Directions was started by a Roman Catholic priest having a vision and asking for the church's permission to pursue this vision. And what he did is he started a nonprofit organization that would not have a direct tie to the church. And he went out to several local schools in Chicago. And in fact, the school that I teach at was the first. And I was there at the local school council meeting where he presented this. And he said that he identified that there was a need for values education in young people. And he had a program of study that was not religious based, but yet taught basic values that were important to the families in our community and the students. And that he would like to pilot his program at our school. They did. It amounted to two individuals trained by his organization coming in 2 days a week and pulling out from classrooms at the teacher's recommendation students that, because of some inner need, were not connecting appropriately, that succeeding in their studies was in their own best interest.
And having us take two such troubled young people and one parent those two with a successful student, and then have all three come down, and it was students talking to other students about values education, what has worked for the successful student. And this has blossomed, now it's in other high schools in Chicago, now they're going down into Texas and so on, and it's become a tremendous program, but it was because one committed church-based individual didn't necessarily, I don't believe, have to be a professional, but had this vision. And I'm wondering, your question about your congregation and the united vision, until there's a united vision, until there's some consensus that what we are thinking of do can make a difference, but then are we free enough to want to risk going out on our own and not thinking that we have to go up through some other goal organizations or through multi-denominational organizations in order to work for social justice. It's just an example from that experience.
Maybe in kind of defense of the generation of that's privatizing, and in looking back on recent history, don't you think that these days that people, pastors, etc., that you're focusing on, and people in congregations, because of the dramatic growth in communication, television, radio, talk shows, that people are being bombarded now with feeling an obligation to interpret to judge every issue of the day, every legislative issue of the day, every issue that the radio reports on, that they highlight for the week, that Congress is taking up. And that, it seems to me, has created a lot more pressure on individuals to make judgments and to act, and then to act. And I'm wondering if that isn't causing people to, or this may be a reason for people to say, that's not an easy thing to do, and that's maybe not a very wise thing to do. Maybe it is better to use the church as a source of refreshment and empowerment and sharing in your community, and use that once you're refreshed to go out into the world and be active in your community, in your an organization outside of the church. I guess I just proposed that.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the last part of what you're saying is that different from what I'm saying, too. I'm saying the refreshment, the energizing, the understanding, the faith comes alive in the midst of that engagement out there. I mean, that's part of what I'm saying. But in terms of the earlier part of what you're saying, I would feel more comfortable, yeah, certainly the huge impact of media of all kinds on us, I think, is you know, a distinctive mark of our age. I'm afraid, though, that much of that ends up being soundbite rather than the kind of information that leads to a careful, thoughtful assessment, analysis of what's going on. It's like, well, which side do I line up? And, you know, and more often than not, it's very much a self-interest appeal. You know, what's in my interest without a sense of, well, what about the wider sense of public good? So I agree, people are being bombarded with a lot, but I think in the midst of that, that if anything, is why the church, from out of its basic understanding of the faith, being able to suggest, not a matter of saying, well, therefore we need to do this and this and this. I don't think the church can be quite so sure of, you know, what all needs to happen out there. But I think there are some, a sense of, hey, you know, God calls us to be concerned about the least and about, you know, a lot of the other biblical kinds of messages that come through. and helping members of our churches to think through, what does that mean? You know, what's going on out there with all that stuff we're being bombarded with? So I guess what I'm speaking against is saying, well, there's all this information out here, and then there's the church being refreshed here, and it's like, well, church should stay with this because all this other stuff is going on out here. I think we need to take seriously the intersection between the two.
But the call for the church to lead as an organization is quite different, as she mentioned, as she brought up, than calling for individuals to take action. And I'm hearing you call for the church to take more action.
Well, the church as the people of God. So it is individuals living out their callings, but it also, I think, needs to be individuals working together. And it may not be so much the church taking the lead as the church, when it gathers, being clear about bearing witness that hey, as people are engaged in their workplace, as they're engaged in affecting these changes in their schools or whatever, that itself, those are means through which God operates, and we need to name that. I think what I'm talking about is the more public naming of those kinds of actions that we either individually or corporately are engaged in already, rather than saying, oh, well, that's all that secular stuff we do off there. I guess, if anything, it's a plea to say what we tend to think of as the private, and that's the sacred religious stuff here, and then there's all that ugly secular stuff out there. It's that kind of distinction that I think we need to challenge.
What I hear you suggesting, in part, is to win as an individual or a group of individuals, when you are taking some type of action, saying, you know, I guess publicly claiming that it's because you are a person of God.
Yeah, I think we can.
It's not because I belong to this particular church. It's right. Because I'm trying to be a disciple of God, and mm-hmm. that's why I'm doing this. Not because I want someone to feel better, or, I mean, that'd be the result.
Forward, did you want to say something?
I think you gave a wonderful example for the consequence of a person. But I think sometimes it's a consequence of our individualistic thinking, that we think primarily from a single person out, mm-hmm. not from the institution. I think we have to find more than our willing hearts, our good hearts, our good intentions. We have to find institutions. Maybe I give an example. Sometimes we can do in an institution with other people what we can't do for us alone. For example, sometimes we can pray with people, and we can't pray. We are too weak to pray when we are alone. And that's the same as a political vision. Sometimes we are open for political vision when we are supported by an institution. And that's the power of the church, that it's not only the sum of the good hearts of the single ones, but the institution where people are used to think so, where people are used to be aware about needs of others and so on. Mm-hmm. And the institution is more than the power of the single ones. And mm-hmm. therefore, and I think we can.
And I was very much reminded of that when we were reading this Josiah text. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so obvious how it speaks to our individualistic search for spiritual comfort. And Isaiah says, no, sorry, go away with this fasting. It doesn't interest God. Mm-hmm. Go away with this search. But God is interested in the bread of your neighbor. And in what you always call, I wondered about that, Karen, you spoke about the common good, the bonum commune. I think in our official politics, this doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. There is no such a thing as a common good. Mm-hmm. That's a dated concept. Mm-hmm. And postmodernity, in a way, means really to get rid of that. There are only individual interests. Mm-hmm. And the ideology is that this works then out for everyone, but it doesn't. Mm-hmm. You need victims to have people whose basic human rights are violated. It is a human right to go to school, to have a school, to have decent teachers, and all of that, and to have health care, etc., etc.
Perhaps one of the things that we can do as members of congregations is to empower our pastors and our leaders, our lay leaders, mm-hmm. to do things that will promote social justice. The right of a child to go to school. In the area where my school is, we have a safety problem crossing gang lines in order to get to the school. And so a group of ministers have come in and started to meet with our administrators, and we've worked out a way that we can apply for board funds for buses to bus students from feeder elementary schools into the school, because then the students will not have to walk across under viaducts where there may be some gang-to-gang mm-hmm. confrontations. And that's those churches had to free up their pastors and say, go in and work in this way.
That this is part of the calling of the church.
And individually, there are tutoring programs in those schools, those churches, and so on. And maybe if we're not in a setting, we can adopt sister churches and help them to be empowered financially or with volunteers from our other congregations to work in these kinds of ways. I think they're powerful ways to work.
I'd like to add something that is from a different dimension. And I've had the privilege most of my time of working in black churches. Mm-hmm. And the black community doesn't have these schizophrenic splints. I mean, even the fundamentalist black churches are out there with community issues. Because, let's face it, historically, so often the white power structure ignored them. So the only thing they could do was fight for their community. So I live in Pasadena, where there is this openness to, and it's an involvement with the issues. Often it's the small issues. Why do we always have to have a cause that we make banners for? It's the small issues that get people involved in the process, and to see that their issues for their personal strengthening within a congregation is just one part of what they're doing. It isn't an either or ever.
Right.
And that, and also our government. I mean, when we had our new mayor come in, he invited the black churches to meet with him to see how we can work together. So my experience is that we shouldn't always see government as opposed to involvement. When we're asked to be involved,
well,
he assumes we're going to be
right.
Involved.
And I think we are in an interesting era where more and more people coming at it from a secular perspective, I'll use that distinction for a minute, are saying, yeah, there is an important public role of religion. And not just, I mean, obviously we've got some examples that probably most of us in this room might cringe about in terms of some of the religious right, et cetera, but there's another way of how do we talk about, and I mean, I agree with what you're saying, Duarte, you know, there's been an evaporation of the common good. And whether we use that language or other language, I think part of the calling of the church in our day is to hear those different voices, to work together, to raise up some values, and to be there for the long haul when lots of other folks wear out pretty quickly. You know, there's a kind of promise, you know, this Isaiah promise and others that propels us forward for the long haul. And I think that's part of what means that, yeah, the church is there even when others give up. Obviously, we could have talked a lot more about specific things that could be done, but I just during this hour want to at least make the point of I think this is central to our theological calling as a church and not just peripheral. So, thanks for your...